I wanted, therefore, to address a question that perhaps we could all be participants in, and that is how to become acquainted with our extended family. Some of you have grandchildren. Some few may have great-grandchildren, but we'll limit it to the grandchildren. Some of you have children. Some of you are contemplating marriage. Some of you wished you could contemplate it. But for financial reasons or otherwise, that's down the road. It is unlikely, in addressing this question, that we have fully seen how valuable grandparents are, because we have taken for granted a new system called babysitters, which usually involve teenage children of one's neighbors. Our society has completely altered the real pattern that would make for success. And many of you are of an older generation, and I would like to have all of you see whether it's possible to function this way. In your case, of course, will vary. But it would be worth considering in terms of at least explaining it to others. What we need is an understanding of how properly to handle relationships within a family. One of the problems that has tended to separate grandparents and their children and the grandchildren is a view that shouldn't be, commonly has been thought to be universal, it isn't, and yet undoubtedly has been important enough that it has played a role. We'll say in simple terms, it's the mother-in-law. Now, there's nothing wrong with a mother-in-law. That is, unless there is something wrong. So, if there is already a mother-in-law problem, we could also say father-in-law, but the other way is described, how can you imagine the mother-in-law being that close to the grandchildren when you already want to exclude her from the grandchildren at the very time your children are young? Certainly you wouldn't want it that the mother-in-law gets involved more and more as the children grow up. So what we have, interestingly, is an American stereotype that somehow there's always something wrong. Usually it is with, you know, the father's mother or the mother's mother, however the problem may be. And it could just as well be men, but that's the way it is pictured in cartoons. Much of the cartooning goes back to reality, however. The reality is that people don't know just how and where to draw the line in terms of knowing whose responsibility, let's say what responsibilities are properly exercised by mother and father, and what responsibilities can be legitimately exercised by grandparents. Now, we all grew up in variable backgrounds outside of the church, sometimes inside, but mostly outside. Mr. Tkach has mentioned that when he visited his father, no matter how old he was, when he was in his father's home, father was boss. Now, that's a little strong for the typical American to take. Nevertheless, it illustrates one aspect. Then there is the other, where grandfather, that is your father, never appears. There is the case often of a mother-in-law, not uncommonly the husband's mother, who wants to be sure that the children are reared like she reared her children, and notices very quickly everything that her daughter-in-law we might say, does differently, but she sees it as doing wrong. Now, all of this goes back to the fact that as a nation, we have long since lost a relationship that would have avoided this problem, a relationship that would have kept parents, grandparents, and then grandchildren close to each other so the problem would never have arisen. But in our society, dating has been allowed so freely that we often let young people choose mates from families whose backgrounds are so different from our own that you cannot avoid a mother-in-law problem or a father-in-law problem. Almost everything the other family did was different, you see. They ate differently. They drank differently. They went to different churches. They had different attitudes toward education, different attitudes toward practically everything. And although this doesn't always turn out to be the case, the fact remains that many choices of marriage in times past and even today can bring together families of very diverse backgrounds, in which case it is not easy for grandparents to play a role without seeming to intrude. One of the problems that I even perceive in the way church members, the churches of God, think is this. Parents often say, well, our children are in college. And if they become interested in the third or fourth year with someone else and contemplate marriage, as long as it's all right with the ministers, or as long as it's all right with the dean of students, or as long as it's all right with the college, then the feeling is that it's their responsibility, it's not mine. I've heard this expressed. I don't think it's true in many cases, but it's true in some cases and sufficient in number that I hear it and I don't like the thought. Now, in many cases, young people visit the in-laws happily. In most instances, they are both members of the church or of the same religious background. That's fine if that can be done. But where it is often left to young people, it is one thing to be attracted to someone, one thing to attend church services with the same person, to be on the sports field with the same person, to be seated in class and find certain subjects, certain of our art areas, music, let's say, something that brings us together. The things that we can share in college are only a part of life and not the whole. I learned long ago how easy it is for young people, because of our children, to enjoy the company of other children their own age, fascinating personalities. In the school setting, there was no problem. Outside of the school setting, then other things begin to be noticed. Differences. And then when you meet the family members, you notice even more differences. And when those differences are significant, then it is difficult to bring the grandparents in terms of their role in helping, shall we say, babysitting if they're nearby. That's an awful term. I don't like it. I much prefer the term grandparenting. That's what they should be doing instead of babysitting. The role of grandparents should be that of grandparenting. The role of parents should be that of parenting. But we have opted for the daycare centers, for babysitters, for television, and for any number of other options, and for, you know, older members of the family. It's all right to have older brothers and sisters help. But all these things indicate that we long since, at least for three generations, have gotten away from knowing the extended family, So let me take a few pointers along the way here. It is important, and what I want to say would be something that can't be worked out in one generation. It will work out for some and won't work out for others that soon. The law of God brings a penalty sometimes to the third and fourth generation. Mr. Armstrong has often said lack of education will have a major impact even to the third and fourth generation before we get everybody to the level that we don't have the inner city ghetto and the country side ignorance that has, you know, afflicted every nation. What we need is to start, and we can start with the college. We can start with the local church. We need to encourage parents to remain interested in what their mature children of college age, graduates from high school, if they don't come to Ambassador, what they're doing. Now, I'm starting at the level, let's say, of those who are approaching 20, those who are beyond, at that level where your parents are close to you. That's the relationship. Then I want to start and follow from there in terms of what should be done thereafter, but that's the best place to start. It is important that a father or a mother, step-parents if necessary, be aware of what their young people are doing. I will cite a few things that I have learned from our own family experience. I will suggest there are some biblical experiences with parallels. The life of David is probably the best. Mr. Armstrong has said some significant things in the autobiography, the volume one that had been in print and is available in some of our libraries and should be in your own home library. Fathers and mothers should be aware of what the young people are interested in as they approach the end of high school or as they approach the end of college, depending on their educational level. You should be conscious of the young people of the opposite sex that they may be interested in dating. You should know when they date, whom they date, why they date, where they date. And you should see that you come to see the parents of those whom they may date, even if it is not serious. Now, it can be done without intruding. To illustrate, our son, we had one, dated a young lady whom he did not marry for the senior prom in the public high school. Imperial was then closed. There was another occasion where during the summer there was an open house at a place where he worked, and he had invited her to come to the open house, and he invited her mother to come. And of course, anybody who worked there could invite friends, and one of his friends was my wife and myself. So what happened is that we got to see not only a young person in school of his age, just a friend, we also got to see her mother. She got to see us. We could, in a sense, size up the judgment. Now, there were religious differences there, and we didn't want to follow through on that, and neither did he. It was simply an appropriate social matter for the school, and we felt it proper. But the point is, there were opportunities not only to see the young person but to get acquainted with the family member or members. This kind of thing is not often sufficiently thought of. Now, I got a good idea as to the kind of person that he might have been interested in because I got some idea just from that one occasion of the character of the young woman and of her mother. What was more interesting later is that he ultimately became interested in a young woman whose brothers he knew first before he became acquainted with the young woman whom he finally married. Now, it is interesting to realize how often young people only think of one member of the family. They don't think of the other members of the family. It is very important for us to realize that perhaps the best test of whether a young woman is right for a young man or vice versa is to see whether her brothers or her sisters, younger or older, are the kind of people that you like to be around just as friends. I had met some of the brothers before I met the young woman who is our daughter-in-law. And I found the family interesting. I found the father interesting. I found the mother interesting to be around. The father is a fascinating person. All the brothers were interesting, and the oldest sister is a bilingual educator. I find it very easy to talk with her. Now they have different religious backgrounds, very variable, which I don't need to go into. But what you will often find, and at Pasadena we have Imperial, but Pasadena is only one place where we have churches. We have no Imperial anywhere else in the country. So we might as well be realistic. You need to know what young people are interested in, whom they are interested in. Generally, that interest should be satisfied within the local congregation. Sometimes it will go into the school situation. Because, as it turned out, our son and daughter-in-law have both been baptized since they were married. But it can go beyond. It is very important, therefore, that as parents you take seriously looking at the background of families whom your children date. Now, don't assume that dating has to start seriously. Earlier than this, when our son was about 14, that's the first time we had him in the company of other young women, other than his sisters. And there was a nice church family, and I knew the sons and daughters of the family, and I said, well, what he needs is an experience to see how other girls are besides his own sisters. And so we had a dinner occasion after the Day of Atonement at one time. His comment afterward was interesting. He said, why, they smile. They're friendly. You know, it made him realize that it wasn't a challenge to sit across the table from a girl about your age. And for some young men, it is a challenge, because they simply have never known how, and it's always good to find somebody who's a reasonably good conversationalist. I mean, you don't want to put one wallflower on one side and the other wallflower on the other side. You want at least the possibility of give and take, so social life can become a kind of easier experience outside the immediate family. We learned that it is important that you come to know the near relatives, not perhaps alone the brothers and sisters of someone whom you may be interested in marrying, but that you like the father and the mother, and especially for young men that you like the mother's cooking. Because that may be significant later. Now, in the case that I am referring to, mother cooks marvelous menudos. That is, she really knows how to make cow's stomach tasty. She comes from Costa Rica, and there, that is one of the standard fares. But you have to know how. In fact, sometimes our son went to the house not to see the young lady, but to see her mother and enjoy dinner with the rest of the family. That is, I think, a way of breaking down barriers in a hurry where you feel comfortable. I had this experience when I first met my wife's family. We grew up in a very ethnic neighborhood in Northern California, but it was in the countryside, not in the city. I was even at times in a school in which there wasn't anybody with an English surname. I could say in one class where I was, we had somebody who spoke Portuguese, somebody who spoke Spanish, no, that's wrong, who spoke Italian, Polish, Hungarian, German, and Russian. All of those were all in one class that was hardly more than probably 12 students. Almost everybody in the class was bilingual. That was interesting to realize. We get acquainted with others. So there were certain kinds of people I grew up with. And when I met my wife's father and mother, and my wife's mother's brother's family and in-laws, something struck me, and I have said it before, so you'll pardon me for those of you who have heard it, I will say it again. I found that the in-laws of my wife's family were every bit as interesting as her family. That is, they chose to marry the kind of people I knew and I grew up with. And so it was possible to communicate. They spoke Czech and German on the one side. All of them were bilingual. And it was interesting to see that if I had met those people at home, they would be like the people I knew when I grew up. Now that told me something, because I have performed marriages for some people away from here, or I have been responsible for funerals. And I see the various family members get together at a wedding or a funeral. And the best way to describe it is after the name of a television program, Family Feud. You really wonder how they ever got together. The person who smokes, the person who can't stand smoking, the person who clearly is an alcoholic, and the other person who never touches a drink. The one who's secular and agnostic, and the other is religious. Combinations that just simply, when you take a look at the group assembled, make no sense. There's no cohesion. No possibility of having the kind of role I'm speaking about of grandparents, parents, and grandchildren being molded in a tradition. So it is important that you become acquainted as early as possible with not only the immediate family members, but others afterward. One step removed, those whom they intermarry with. Now, you don't need to go this far in terms of dating. And now let me explain that Mr. Armstrong at this point says something important. If you date someone once, you should be reasonably enough in control of yourself to know you're not going to fall in love right away. If you think the person is an individual that you could appreciate enough to want to marry in the future, that is, the relationship is such that there's no reason why it might not be possible, but if you see clearly it shouldn't be, Mr. Armstrong has said, don't date that person again. Don't put him or her in jeopardy. You see, there are people whom you could be attracted to, but maybe for religious reasons you shouldn't marry. There may be people where there are serious today problems of alcohol and drug abuse and other factors. You simply shouldn't marry. Even if you find the person attractive and otherwise acceptable, you may realize that the answer is no, then don't date the person again. If you're not sure whether you could be attracted to the individual, then Mr. Armstrong has suggested, wouldn't hurt to do so a second time. But don't get involved with second and third dates when it is quite clear for some one reason or another it would be a mistake to marry that person, and at the same time the person might be attractive. Now, I can understand if the person is not someone whom you would be interested in one way or another, then that is not quite the same thing. Mr. Armstrong would understand that in college, too. But when there is any potential seriousness that might soon develop, then one wants to know immediately whether you should draw the line now or whether you should extend the interest further by becoming acquainted with relatives and family as soon as possible so that you do know. All right, let us suppose now the right choice has been made. So now we want to really pick up where it ought to start. That is, having young people who've made the right decisions in the first place, now we want to go on with the rest of the story in terms of how to make all the things work in terms of your children, which means your parents' grandchildren. Assuming that you have discussed the matter of children and there is an understanding, this is not an age in which we should all plan for 9 or 10 children in the family. Even 8 is too much today. I hope we understand what I'm saying there. We leave it to the individuals to plan. There's not a church doctrine which tells you how many and when. But it is your responsibility. Now, apart from the matters of health, there is, and there are things, mentioned them in her articles off and on over the last few years. We will not deal at this moment so much with the physical. We will deal with the psychological, the emotional, and those factors. Before children are born, any mother especially knows that there are differences in the behavior if she has more than one when the second one comes around or the third. There are clear differences of behavior of infants, shall we say fetuses at an earlier stage, in the womb. They do not all respond in the same way. They can hear the same music. You can be eating the same thing. You know, all the environment, as far as you know, is the same, but heredity is going to make a difference. We can say, we had 4 children, that some were clearly livelier than others. Our son never moved in the womb. He just didn't make any move at all, so we named him Man of Peace. That's what he's called, Manfred. He never got into a fight in school except once, and the first thing he did was to call chicken, which was the safer thing. The next day the other fellow was expelled. So that solved that problem. But he has a way of getting along with people. We had another child that was constantly kicking mother. Not squirming, but kicking. I mean, you know, thrusting the leg, thrusting the arm. I mean, it was amazing. She's been that way ever since. It just bounces through life. Same family and same parents. Then our youngest daughter was very quiet. She wasn't as quiet as our son, but she never, that may sound strange, she never turned over or wanted to turn over in her crib until she was 8 months old. She was perfectly satisfied being placed in whatever position her mother put her. Now, none of the other children were quite like that. She's the one who, when she went to school and finished her work, and she sat at the table like this, and the teacher didn't notice that she wasn't doing anything because she wasn't doing anything. She'd already finished her lesson, you see. And then when Imperial closed, she got to a public school and did her lesson and sat quietly at the table waiting for the next assignment. The teacher thought that she was psychologically inhibited and called us in. And we told her very clearly that we grew up at a time when children were told to be quiet, not like your school is. I was a little more cautious, but that's the feeling. Today it is so different. But it is important for mothers and fathers, but mothers can sense this obviously, especially all the time, that there are differences in the way children will respond physically and will respond emotionally. This is also reflected in interests in music. The one that I referred to that likes to, you know, fling different parts of her body around is one that simply appreciates what I would call the music that has rhythm and beat more so than the other children who prefer something more quiet. I learned there that there is, in fact, a relationship to the appreciation of different kinds of music with the way children are made up physiologically and therefore also undoubtedly mentally and emotionally. The youngest girl, who is very quiet, is the one who plays the piano in the family. She chooses her music. She likes the music we had at home, learned to play it, had some instruction one summer. But the interesting thing is, without any real guidance from us, because it didn't turn out to be necessary, we just didn't find it necessary, she chooses those rhythms, those sounds of music that I and my wife find pleasing and comfortable to be around at home. Two of the other children, who were reared more closely with the church as a whole because of imperial schools rather than in the public school, because they were in imperial longer, tend to like music that's a little more modern than what, let's say, I grew up with. But we recognize that, and we have tried to provide the kind of musical education at home, a few records. We don't have, I don't even have a tape player for music. I'm very backward. And we certainly don't have earplugs that keep the rest of the world outside. We simply never got beyond the record. That's just the way it is. But that was satisfactory with the family at the time that the children grew up. And we tried to provide different kinds of music for them. So here I am emphasizing something that is important even from early times on. Children listen to music and make choices. The one thing we tried to do was to educate them about the character of music and words by having them listen to the singing commercials on radio. And it was an education. Once in a while there was an intelligent composition. Generally speaking, it was obnoxious. And the children soon learned that it was obnoxious. And most people overlook how it is possible without going outside of the kitchen, not even away from the kitchen table. It's possible to educate children about music. You may be listening to the news and you know an ad comes on. It's significant that you can show when there is a special character that is being emphasized. Have you ever noticed that BMW, Cadillac, and Volvo have different music, different words, different themes than some other cars that will remain unnamed? It's because they assume there is a different character behind the person who is interested in your product. Now, we're not here trying to emphasize the product. We're actually explaining to the children, did you hear as they were growing up, did you hear whether that was logical? Did you listen to what was being said? Hence, in music, you should know what is being said. What did you think of the impact of the music? What was the mood that it put you in terms of the product? So we wanted them to think about these things. And music is, of course, the most important medium that exists in terms of the development of emotion. And it's what's linking young people today more than ever before, because it's possible to have music cheaper than at any time in human history. Of all sorts. I mean, there was a time you might have played music just for yourself, but in terms of having others perform for you, there was a time when only kings could afford to have small ensembles. Now it's possible to have the grandest operatic performance. It's possible to have the most wretched music available. Everything is available for your choice today. The devil is pro-choice. That's what he was in the Garden of Eden, and that's the way it has become. So it is important that you recognize that from early on, you do know the differences in emotional responses of your children. And you sense that there will be different interests, musically and otherwise. It is not enough for the parent simply to say no. You should provide the environment for intelligently, emotionally thinking a problem through. One of our ministers, I thought it was very nice that in this case it was one of our black ministers at the summer camp, was addressing the question. And I say that because of the impact of black musical performers in the country. And I think that he really asked some very fine questions of young people at our summer camp last year when I briefly was there. What he found from church members' children, I thought was interesting. I believe I had addressed it once here, but it's proper to bring it again. He found, in eliciting the question, that the bulk of young people had been given money and bought their records and brought them home, the tapes usually, and then the parents would have them play, and if they liked them, they let them keep the record, and if not, they either had to dispose of them or maybe exchange them, whatever. But it put the parent in the position of having to say no. The parent was the one who had to say no. The child is the one who made the decision as to what the yes would actually be by having made the choice in the first place. The problem was that the parents had let the children make all the decisions in the first place. My wife and I never let our children buy any music by themselves for years. We didn't buy it for them. We bought it with them. That is, we discussed what they would like to hear, and we went down and we analyzed. We have so much. It doesn't have to be much money. We never did put much in. But we have so much to spend today for that. Now, here we looked at different composers, different periods of time, and we helped them make choices, but we were there. We steered their thinking. That's what parents are for. Not to let the child make the thinking, so that everything that's ultimately approved was the child's choice. We offered suggestions as to what this particular record would offer. It means you should have at least some knowledge of the music yourself in the first place. You don't have to have an in-depth knowledge. You have to have enough to sense. And sometimes, of course, if we had seen an excellent movie, you can understand the sound of music that children would want something like that, Fiddler on the Roof. And then we come back from the South Pacific and we brought a record home on Fiji Rock. Let not you be offended at this point, because Fiji Rock is proper for Fiji. The fact remains, rock can be an acceptable rhythm in some environments. It doesn't have to be anything like heavy metal and stuff like that. But it is possible to make you understand an environment and make you understand the thoughts and intents of composers by explaining to children what you've learned, and they begin to pick it up. We tried to do that all the way along in that particular area. So we associated the children's rhythm, the children's appreciation of the world around. We found that one of our children was interested in guitar playing, as another was interested in the piano. And so we bought a guitar, and he learned to play, and we were very pleased that he tended to find those rhythms that seemed to our ears appropriate. Of course, then you can buy music books at different age levels to assist. And it doesn't have to be expensive. These are all paperbacks. You don't have to go beyond that. All right. Just as, in other words, we have in the Bible the story of Isaac and Rebekah, you remember, with the two children who quarreled in the womb, that is Esau and Jacob, and you sense the difference of the personality right there within the family. So you must become aware of differences of personality with your children, and don't try to make each one in the same mold. Some will grow up making decisions early in life. It is general that boys are likely to postpone decision-making till later in life in terms of what their interests are. I would say that our son didn't really make up his mind until we made it up for him at age 15. He had a responsibility in a class that he chose. Now, we said, look, you chose the class. It's one of the options in school. We did not choose it for you. Since you voluntarily chose it, you must live up to the commitments of that class. Now, go do what the class assignment requires. We never had to say that to any of our girls, but our son was a little less interested. But when we insisted, you know, and we simply saw that he started to work, and we got him the tools he needed to, it was in his drafting class, it turned out that within one semester, he was already the best draftsman in Southern California in the Los Angeles school system. But he had to be forced by us to pay attention to what the teacher was telling him. Happily, his teacher was the best teacher in California. So, if the teacher were a bad teacher in the sense of poor, that would have been unfortunate. But he was an excellent teacher. Now, our other children, we didn't have to, you see, push them in a certain direction. Our youngest girl, especially, was interested in her field. We could tell it by the time she was age 6. She was already interested in architecture. Now, that's a little unusual for a girl. And it's a little unusual even for the age. But you know, there are Mrs. Ettinger. Many of you do not remember the Ettingers. He was in the music department working with Mrs. Lucy Martin. The Ettingers have since died. Mrs. Ettinger became interested in music by the time she was age 3. She wanted to climb on the piano stool and play the piano. Well, our youngest daughter was interested in architecture, and when she passed by new buildings that she would see, she would go home, and within minutes she would have the new building built that she had seen. And she has retained this interest and now is in college doing this kind of work. But she's a self-disciplined person. Not every child is equally disciplined. There are children who take advantage of a parent. There are children who don't take advantage of a parent. And parents must always be in charge. You don't have to be bossy, you just have to be in charge. My wife discovered that one of our children, by the time she was age 2, or maybe it was only 1.5, but very, very early, was, in a sense, making the decisions. And mother was doing this and that, and finally she realized, look, I'm in charge. I have to decide how my time is to be taken care of. So we learn that in a family, a mother sometimes has to say, no, I don't have time now. You will have to wait. You will have to wait. Now, there are children who don't take advantage of a situation like that. But those things you soon discover. And by disciplining a child after instruction, now there is a time perhaps to discipline before instruction when there's an emergency, and discipline appropriately in the sense that if you didn't say anything in advance, you need to just be sure that it is serious enough to know that it was a serious mistake. But you want to instruct in advance. Then discipline comes when there is a breakdown in obedience. Too often we explain only after the problem has arisen. We don't want to say, don't you know you shouldn't have done that? Well, of course the answer is no, you don't know because you never were told. You want to tell a child what should be done, what shouldn't be done, what the limits are. In any case, you want the child to be responsive and to recognize that some have significant initiative on their own, and some have self-discipline to go with it, and some have to have it, and some have to be pushed, and some have to be reined in, all in the same family. We have to recognize that. And undoubtedly, even in the same person, there are areas where you allow yourself liberty. Our daughter-in-law once said of her youngest sister-in-law, something that was very interesting. The one comes from the Spanish background, and our one daughter is a German of Germans when it comes to discipline. And I've said this on an occasion, I will repeat it here, because it illustrates how different traits have to be recognized and worked with. Our daughter-in-law said one day, what must it be like to be a German who enjoys fun only when she plans for it? Because in this case, we have one child who can have as much fun as anybody else if it's planned for. And if it's not in the plan for the day, there will be none. That's all. It wasn't planned for. It just won't exist today. There are other things. Whereas our daughter-in-law can shift, you know, with whatever was the most wonderful thing at the moment to do. And they both get along very well, but it makes you realize that sooner or later it's possible for a mother who has the Latin approach to life to have a child who doesn't, that might have traits inherited from her husband, see, that come down from another family that you don't expect. So it's good that you sense what other people are like in the family and know that you may find people of different traits of character that you didn't have in your family that simply show up in another. Our children and our in-laws have all mentioned that the areas where there is the biggest difference are those areas in which culturally there had been no experience like whatever it was before, because none of the other side of the family had ever done things in life this way. There are people who get up later than others. And you have to recognize that you may have married into a family where people rise early, and it's simply different, and it's disturbing. And you may have married into a family where people rise later, and it's different, and it's disturbing. This can happen. These are all the little things that you need to keep your eyes open to along the way as children grow up. That way, when you become grandparents much later, you'll be prepared to recognize those differences, because someone tends to rise later doesn't mean the person is by nature lazy. That person may have, in fact, stayed up later the night before, because that's the body rhythm. That's the difference. It can be cultural and physiological. All along the years, it is important to have conversation with children. Teach them things that they should learn to be able to learn how to speak. And to recognize also that there are things that they will see parents do that they should not yet do. We'll illustrate a point. One of our three-year-old grandson is bilingual by the circumstances. And, mother might say, "I told you to do this." And she says, "Dije," that is, "I said," or "I told you." And I won't finish the thought. And so the little grandson goes to his bilingual grandparent and says, "Dije," that is, "I told you, Grandpa." Now he's using the same word, see. So grandfather, of course, has to explain to him that "I tell you," "you don't yet tell me." So you have to beware that when you use expressions, even commands, that you learn to explain to children how they should address others of a different age level. That is, they should learn how to respond to people of different age levels and know that you respond differently because you're older. And when the child becomes older, then the child learns to say things a little differently. And that's proper. All those things we should learn to do in advance. It's important to know when to encourage children to be quiet, as well as when to encourage them to converse. And there will be differences in families. We were in a restaurant in New York in the Jewish section, and it was one of these kosher restaurants, and there were a group of young Jewish children. They must have been somewhere between 7 and 9 years of age. They were in that age group, I would estimate. And there was a young man, middle-aged man at most, taking care of them. And I'll tell you, it was a different culture. They were all over and around the table and enjoying each other and couldn't stay in a chair. And it was simply fun around the table. And here were Gentiles at this other table where we were, and all the children were quiet, Germanic and obedient, hopefully, at least different. And he came over and he said, "How do you do it?" Well, the answer is we weren't working with the same youngsters, that's all. Now, in a family, we have some very lovely people of Hebraic background here that can understand. You know, I admired the capacity of those young people to be responsive. But in our family, we have one child who generates more conversation than all the rest of the family put together. She simply does. We can all be at home, and it's quiet. Everyone doing his or her thing, and this one can come in, and from then on, the decibels are different. I mean, there are some children who just generate ideas. Generate ideas. She doesn't generate leadership, she generates ideas. You know, there are differences. You should know when your children have leadership and know when they should not over-exercise it, and recognize when children don't have leadership in the same way. There are some young women who, as they grow up, you will soon recognize need a man who can make strong, firm, logical decisions, because some girls are less sure of themselves than others. And in the same family, this can be true. Mr. Armstrong mentioned that he had one daughter who he said was a glutton for punishment. And the mother said the other daughter can be reasoned with. Now, we can always, of course, notice those differences. There are some you have to discipline more than others. There are some you can reason with, in the sense that the mere logic makes sense, and the other child wants to do it whether it's logical or not, you know. Those differences of how you approach the mind of a child are very important. So one should recognize where the child is heading and what kind of friends that child ought to be seriously thinking about later in life. When the question of, dating should arise. You don't stop to think of it only when the first date has occurred. It's something you should put your mind to when a child is little. You should also encourage a child to have an answer to those questions that a child needs about sex and about birth early in life. Now, that's a part of good education, because one of the great problems today is the explosion in homosexuality and lesbianism, so much so that, as I have said, and I think it is true based on what I am learning step by step, there probably isn't a congregation of the Church of God in a large metropolitan area that doesn't have less than 5 people who have gone through, in one way or another, the mental and emotional experience of homosexuality or lesbianism. That's true. No doubt, right here, some of you have gone through that experience or are still wrestling emotionally with the problem. So it is important that you have identification. One of our grandchildren said about his little sister, about 2.5 years younger, "But she's different." Yes, she's different. There's no such thing as unisex, at least not in our family. Then he said an interesting question. "Mother," his probably word was mommy, "why are you different?" Now is the time to explain. 3 years old, not just before the first date. It's time to explain when the curiosity is satisfied with the fact that there are anatomical differences. And you explain on the basis of who nurses and from whom the child is born. It's a whole lot easier to explain these things, actually, when you have more than one child. too, because then there is a basis, or at least you can share in terms of cousins' experience, you see, if you are nearby. But all of that needs to be taken into consideration. In school, you need to keep up with what the children are learning. It is important that you go to open houses. That is a term that we use to refer to the fact that you can get acquainted with the teachers. We often ask our children, well, how do you evaluate your teacher in terms of effectiveness? Now, we don't try to be negative. We'd like to say, well, how does this person handle his class? Is there something, let's say, that we could provide you? Is this person simply... because we have heard things, you know, week by week, month by month. Is this person really able? And so when we go in, we find that some teachers are truly able, and others are young and inexperienced, and others are simply misfits and shouldn't be in their field. As I said, the drafting teacher that our son had, admittedly, by others in the field, was the best teacher in the state of California. He also was Jewish, which was nice. And our son, he said, was the best student he had ever had in his lifetime in that field of education. So it was a terrific combination, which was one reason why our son had an offer before he was age 16 to do drafting at JPL. Which, when they found out he was not yet 16, he had to be turned down. But it's nice to meet a man like that. He said that as a draftsman, he was a B draftsman, but he said as a teacher, I'm an A teacher, and he knew it. He knew how to teach, and it didn't go to his head in the wrong sense. It was there by nature, and he knew how to teach his field. We had a Greek teacher in art in school also, in the Los Angeles system, an exceptional teacher. There are just some who knew how. We enjoyed meeting some of these individuals, and we met others, and when we saw weaknesses there, and that's true, I couldn't possibly teach every class equally well. There are things that I wouldn't be interested in. And in the grade school and high school, you know, junior high, that whole level, you often have to sometimes teach areas in which you were weaker than in other areas. But then we would want to tell our children how they should approach the subject and what they should do to make the class experience effective, even during that period of time when they wish they could do something else, that is, to profit by it. And you can assist by knowing what's in the literature, what's in the math book, encouraging children to do work on their own if the teacher is limited, or encouraging the children to be as cooperative as possible because some teachers are grumpy. I mean, there are all sorts of people in this profession of teaching. And then above all, to be aware of what's going on in the classroom in terms of the new problem of drugs, alcohol. And there we found some very responsible teachers that we've talked with. Not all, but many, many teachers are truly concerned. Some are embarrassed. It's a teacher who is addicted to tobacco has a far more difficult time wrestling with the problem of marijuana than someone who is not addicted to tobacco. A teacher who regularly drinks too much, and there are such in our system. There are policemen who do, too. There are ministers who do in the world. And shall I say, it can happen in our fellowship? You have to recognize that there are teachers who are quite capable and others who let things happen and don't encourage the children in the classroom to be responsive as they should be. Anyway, it is good to recognize that when you come in an open house, that you see other young children and their parents, I usually find that the kind of parent who attends an open house is either overprotective or there for a good reason. The parents who ought to be there are not. That's one of the great problems. And it was interesting. We would look at things on the board that would be put on the walls, put on display. And we would talk to the children and say, well, now, who did this? Who did this? Who did this? And because this is good work. Would you tell me which one of the children coming through in this open house did this? And we would find those children. And it was good for the other child to know, because we would sometimes walk up to the child's parent or to the child and compliment. And it was also important for our children to learn. We would say, well, now, look, you notice how you did this here, a little sloppy. But look how this child did it. You know, it's good work. And vice versa, we would compliment if our children had done something unusual. Did you notice that this person has not got that technique yet? There are ways of encouraging a child both to see what can be done yet, as well as to see what has been achieved. And we would sometimes find that other young people were, this was long before you come to the dating age in junior high, or primary grades, it would be interesting to see the character of those who were doing best. And we would encourage our children to get to know others who were doing well. And in the class of drafting, for example, where our son was, there were probably three other young men who were doing absolutely superb work, practically equal. It was very hard to distinguish between any of them. And they worked together. They were not competitive, as it turned out, like some. They all took the challenge and encouraged each other to do the best. And that's what you need to do. Our children always appreciated when someone else was excellent in some aspect of art that they didn't have quite the same skill or interest in. To get acquainted and to watch how others were doing it. Or to go over to their house. Our children did a lot of their work at home in terms of academic pursuits. And then, of course, in sports, you can bicycle from home. There are things like that, as well as play tennis or other small group sports. But it's very good to have children learn how others are doing and to see their achievements, and therefore encourage your own in that way. It pays to take them to museums, to take them to musicals. I can remember years ago we took our children, all four of them. The youngest one was very young. It was no use leaving her home. But we took them to the Pasadena Civic Auditorium to see a classical Spanish dance group. And the remarkable thing, ours were the only children in the whole auditorium. And these darling elderly women of Pasadena couldn't believe what they were seeing. You know, that children of, let's say, from 3 to 9 or 10, 3 to 11 as it would be, in that range of age, were all there absorbing what was being performed. And yet that was the time to learn. That was the time to sense rhythms. The time to see how others do things when the children are impressionable, especially. I said this afternoon, and I will now essentially tie it together, one of the most important things that we can do is learn to judge and to teach our children to judge the kind of company they should keep. This is the greatest problem in our public system of education, where parents allow the children to keep whatever company they want to. It is very, very important Many of you don't have children in Imperial or grandchildren in Imperial schools. You come from other areas or you'll be leaving for other areas. It is important that even as grandparents, you work out a program so that your grandchildren and their friends can come over. And when your children don't have time to assess the kind of friendship your grandchildren, you're speaking of the older ones here now, what your grandchildren may be doing, you can play a role. Paul made it very clear when he wrote to Timothy and Titus, it's important that grandchildren teach their children, grandparents teach their children and grandchildren. You don't have to intrude and say things that are really not your responsibility. You want to learn that. Don't be the obnoxious mother or father-in-law. But you should set a sufficient standard in terms of character and quality that it cannot be gainsaid. And it is important that you analyze the friendships. The most important thing, the friendships that are being made. You're thrust in with a large group of people of such diverse background. You need to know how they think, what their interests are, what problems they have. And you need to encourage them to assess the relationship these other young people have with their parents, or as it's coming to be, a parent. It's one of the great tragedies where there's only one because of divorce. And what problems they have. And you need to learn whether you should have contact with them or not. As some people you simply have to shun. And then you need to encourage your children to make the decisions. How to say no to friends and when to say yes. By your experience, you set an example. Your children who are now parents set an example. And once you have these examples set and you give the kind of positive encouragement when you bring your grandchildren to your home or you bring your children, friends home, then they will be able to make a far better decision as they grow into later teens as to whom to date and whom ultimately to choose for a mate. Now, we must stop there. It's 9 o'clock. I had some things here in case I wanted to use them, but I'm not going to. I will only say that if any of you were specifically interested, if you come from Canada or you are in this area, I have the kind of information you might find useful if you wanted to see what is available in terms of instructing young people with essentially free literature or literature that costs practically nothing on alcohol and the drug scene, so that your children will be informed, that you'll be informed.